Dear students, hello. In this exercise class, we shall see, as usually, the solution to last exercise sheet, and this time it was all about the application of the theory of solvable spaces to actually proving the existence of weak solutions of some type of partial differential equations. I mean, those of elliptic type, of course, in a very specific solvable space, which means H2 and H1. So these are the general definitions, and we use again the notation du and d squared u and Laplacian u to denote respectively the weak gradient, the weak Hessian matrix, and the weak Laplacian. I mean, in this case, no ambiguity, there is no ambiguity. In order to solve two of the exercises, it was important to use Poincaré inequalities in two particular cases. In the case of the zero boundary values, in which we assume the open set U to be only bounded, and then we have that there exists a constant C depending on N, P, and U such that the LP norm of small u over capital U is controlled by this constant times the LP norm of the gradient of U for all U in W1 P0, and instead the Poincaré inequality in the zero mean value case. That means if we have U which is open bounded connected with C1 boundary, then the LP norm of the function U in W1P minus its average, which is 1 over the measure of the domain times the integral of U over the domain, is controlled by the constant times the LP norm of du. Notice, just curiosity, but why do we need such a regularity of U here and of the domain U here and here we don't? But roughly speaking, because here U has zero boundary values, you know, in the weak sense, in the sense that it is can be seen as the limit of C infinity C function with respect to the W1P norm, in this sense. Not that it has pointwise values well defined, I mean, in the classical sense. As a trace, yes, but it's a little subtler than that. And so, in a sense, the boundary of U doesn't play a role in this inequality. Instead, here we don't have such assumptions, so the boundary is important. Also, one can ask, well, okay, but then the connectedness, of course, the connectedness is not related to the boundary, but the point is, if we don't put this assumption, the statement is clearly false. Because take as an open set which is with C1 boundary and bounded but not connected. So, for instance, two disjoint balls, and take U to be constant equal to 1 and to, I don't know, any other number different from 1 on the other ball, 0, if you want, and then the average of U will be, of course, it will be 1 half, I mean, no, so it depends if the two balls have the same radius, it will be 1 over the measure of the two balls. The sum of the measure of the balls times the measure of the ball in which U is 1, so it will be a number in 0, 1. So here there will be written the integral of a function which is either 1 or 0 minus lambda in 0, 1, so this is a non-zero integrand, while here, well, the gradient of this function will be 0, of course, and this doesn't make sense. Vabbè, I mean, I don't know if you already saw the proof of this statement, but it basically. It requires this. It's a proof by contradiction, which requires the fact that, in a way, you must find a contradiction working on the fact that you would have a sequence of functions which, on the one hand, converges to a non-zero function, on the other hand, it converges to something with zero gradient. So the function must be constant, but constant with zero average means zero. The trick is that. But this was not relevant to the solution of the exercise, it's only important to your knowledge. So our work, especially the case p equal to 2, and in the case we denote hk of u to be wk2, and hk0 to be wk2 0. These are Hilbert spaces, once equipped with a scalar product given by the sum of the scalar products in L2 between any alpha weak derivative for any multi-index alpha with length less equal than k, and we denote by h minus 1 of u the dual space of 2h1 0, and we write in this way the pairing between the element of h minus 1 of u and h1 0. That's important because H minus one of U, seeing as the dual of the, of course, is a Hilbert space. Eh? And so it's isometric to H1 zero, of course, because all Hilbert spaces are isometric to each other. All separable Hilbert spaces, sorry. But if you want to see it as the dual of H1 zero and not to represent it in a way that it is equivalent to it, you get a rather different way to write elements of H10, and you saw this in the lecture with Professor Nobili. So the first exercise consists in showing that if we take an element V of L2, then the pairing in with respect to in H-1 between V and an element U of H10 is equal to the L2, L2 scalar product between V and U. And this implies that L2 of U is inside H minus 1 of U. So there were many ways of doing it. One could follow what it was done in the lecture, which is basically using the results from Evans' book. Or, here I have two other ideas. Thanks to the Riesz representation theorem, one could say that, look, the dual of L2, which is L2 star, is actually L2. This means, you know, this, so in function analysis, any linear continuous function on L2 can be represented by the scalar product against some fixed element in L2. And so the inclusion H10 inside L2, which is obvious, immediately yields, you know, when you take the dual, you reverse the chain of inclusions between Hilbert, or actually Banach spaces, and so you get immediately that L2 must be inside H-1. And so that any element in L2 actually defines a scalar product in H-1. On the other hand, you can also notice that if V is in L2, let's consider, you know, you have to prove this equality. So let's consider this type of functional, the functional that sends each U in H10 in the scalar product against this V. This is, of course, is linear continuous, but not only on L2, also in H10, because, well, Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, we get L2 norm of U, V, sorry. H2 norm of U, but the L2 norm of U is controlled by the H10 or H1 and the equivalent norm of U, trivially. And this is therefore the scalar product against this V in respect to the L2 Hilbert structure is an element of H-1 because integration, sorry, because integration against an element of H10 gives a linear continuous functional on H10, which is the definition of H-1. This proves the inclusion. Each element V in L2 is inside, gives actually an element in H-1. And the identity, because we denote in this way the pairing between elements of H-1 and elements of H10, and so we're done.